Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Word Wonders, Unlocking English Through Etymology, the podcast where we make learning English words not just easy, but truly fascinating. I'm your host, Chris, and as always, I'm thrilled to have you join us on this linguistic adventure.
And I'm Rachel, here to chime in, ask the questions you might be thinking, and hopefully add a little extra sparkle to our word explorations. Chris, I'm really excited about today's topic. It sounds like we're going to be delving into something very personal.
You got it, Rachel. Today we're going to dive deep into the very essence of what makes each of us unique, our personalities. Every single human being, without exception, is one of a kind. Our personalities are like intricate tapestries woven from countless threads, a combination of both our genetic makeup and the environment we grow up in. It's truly remarkable how we all turn out so differently.
That's so true. You know, sometimes I look at twins and even they, despite sharing so much, have distinct personalities. It's never just one thing, is it?
Absolutely not. The sources tell us that our personalities are shaped by a fascinating interplay of various factors: our culture, our personal growth, our family background, and our environment, all interacting with our inherited traits. It's a complex dance that makes each of us who we are. And what's more, there are certain common patterns, certain types, that emerge from this complexity.
So we're not just unique, but we also fit into categories? That's quite a paradox.
It is, in a way. And today we're going to explore 10 of these fascinating personality types. We'll look at the core ideas behind them, the behaviors associated with them, and then, most excitingly for us, we'll uncover the English words that perfectly describe them, delving into their rich origins to truly understand their meaning.
Oh, I love that. Starting with the idea first, then the word. It's like solving a mystery. So where do we begin, Chris?
We begin with a scenario, Rachel. Imagine someone whose entire approach to life is incredibly straightforward. Every single decision they make boils down to one simple question: what's in it for me? If their drive for personal gain, their selfishness, their ambition, and their ruthless pursuit of self-advancement happens to hurt other people along the way, well, that's just tough luck. Their motto might as well be, "It's a dog-eat-dog world, and I'm not going to be the one left behind." What word comes to mind for such a person?
Selfish, certainly, but I feel like there's a more specific, perhaps even academic term for someone so utterly focused on themselves. Is it an egoist?
Precisely, Rachel. You got it right on the first try. That person is an egoist. They are truly and solely interested in their own welfare. Think of those shrewd business owners or investors, always looking for the best deal for themselves, sometimes even at the expense of others. It's all about their own benefit.
I can definitely picture that type. We see them in stories, in movies, and sometimes even in real life. They're not necessarily evil, but their self-interest is definitely their top priority.
Indeed. Now let's move to our second personality type. Imagine someone who constantly talks about themselves. You might be in a conversation with them, and all you hear is, "Have you heard about all the money I'm making? Did I tell you about my latest amorous conquest? Let me give you my opinion. I know, because I'm an expert at practically everything." They are boastful to the point of being obnoxious. Their conversation is like a one-string violin, and the only tune they play is me, me, me. What they think, what they have done, how good they are, how they would solve the world's problems, and so on, ad nauseum. What do you call this person?
Oh, I know this one. This is the kind of person who dominates the conversation at dinner parties. They're definitely not shy about singing their own praises. Are they an egotist?
Exactly, an egotist. They are literally defined by constantly talking about themselves. It's all about showing off and making themselves the center of attention. Have you ever met someone like that, Rachel?
All too often. It's like they're performing their own one-person show, and everyone else is just an audience member. We all know people like that on social media, constantly posting about their achievements or their luxurious lifestyles, making it seem like their life is a perfect, never-ending highlight reel.
A perfect analogy. Now, let's move to a completely different direction for our third type. Imagine someone who has seemingly discovered the secret to true happiness, and that secret involves dedicating their life to helping others. They don't mind their own interests. Their primary concern is how the next person is getting along. They genuinely care about the welfare of others. What would you call someone like that?
Oh, this is such a refreshing change from the first two. Someone who genuinely puts others first. A truly selfless person. Would that be an altruist?
You're on fire today, Rachel. Yes, an altruist. An altruist is someone who dedicates their life to helping others. Think of those volunteers who spend their holidays helping people in need, or those who generously donate their time and resources to charitable organizations. Not for fame or recognition, but simply because they want to make a difference. In Chinese culture, we value actions like Juren Wei Lei, Juren Wei Lei, finding joy in helping others, which aligns perfectly with the spirit of an altruist.
That's a beautiful concept, and so important. It's wonderful to know there's a word for people who embody such kindness.
It truly is. Now, for our fourth personality type. Imagine someone who, much like a biochemist studying bacteria under a microscope, minutely examines their every thought, feeling, and action. They're often plagued by probing, futile questions like, what do other people think of me? Or, how do I look? Or, maybe I shouldn't have said that. These nagging thoughts are their constant companions because they simply can't grasp that other people don't spend nearly as much time and energy analyzing them as they think.
Oh, this sounds very familiar to some of my own inner monologues sometimes.
Many of us can relate, Rachel. These individuals might seem unsocial, but paradoxically, their greatest desire is to be liked and accepted. They can be shy and quiet, often moody and unhappy, and they much prefer solitude, or at most, the company of one person to being in a crowd. They often have a strong aptitude for creative work and feel uncomfortable engaging in activities that require cooperation with other people. They might even be, or eventually become, a genius. This person turns their mind inward. Any guesses?
This sounds like someone who spends a lot of time in their own head, very reflective. Is this an introvert?
Absolutely, an introvert. They are the ones who turn their minds inward. Think of a quiet scholar who enjoys delving into books, or an artist who finds inspiration in solitude, or perhaps even a programmer who prefers to solve complex problems alone rather than in a noisy team meeting. They recharge their energy when they are by themselves.
I know many people like that, and I think in our society, especially sometimes in quieter moments, we can all appreciate that introspection. It's often where deep thoughts and innovative ideas come from.
Exactly. Now, let's consider the flip side, our fifth type. This person is fantastic in roles like a teacher, a counselor, an administrator, or even an insurance agent. Why? Because they can always become sincerely and vitally interested in other people's problems. They're often the life of the party because they never worry about the effect of their actions and never inhibit themselves with doubts about dignity or propriety. They are usually happy, generally full of high spirits, and they absolutely love to be with people, lots of people. Their thoughts, their interests, their whole personality are turned outward. What's this personality type called?
This sounds like the complete opposite of an introvert. This person thrives on social interaction and external stimulation. This must be an extrovert.
You got it, an extrovert. They are the ones who turn their minds outward. Imagine a charismatic salesperson who can instantly connect with anyone, or a vibrant host who makes everyone feel welcome and entertained. They gain energy from social interaction and are often natural leaders in group settings.
I think we all need a balance of both introverts and extroverts in our lives, don't we? Different situations call for different energies.
You've hit on a very important point, Rachel, because that leads us directly to our sixth personality type. What if you possess both introverted and extroverted tendencies? Meaning, at different times and on different occasions, your interests are turned in about equal proportions, both inward and outward. You're quite normal, in the sense that your personality is like that of most people. So, you turn your mind both inward and outward.
So not an extreme, but a balance. I think this describes most people I know, including myself sometimes. When I need to focus on a big project, I'm more introverted, but when I'm out with friends, I can be quite extroverted. Is there a specific word for this balance?
There is. This person is an ambivert. It's a very common and healthy blend of both worlds. They have the flexibility to adapt their social style based on the situation, finding comfort in both solitude and social gatherings.
That makes a lot of sense. It sounds like the most adaptable and perhaps the most common type.
Indeed. Now, let's shift to a more cynical outlook for our seventh type. Imagine someone who is utterly cynical, embittered, and suspicious. Someone who hates everyone. They might privately, though never openly, hate even themselves. If you talk about the perfectibility of the human race, they'd scoff. Nonsense. No way. Their favorite theme is the stupidity, the meanness, and the crookedness of most mortals. Most? Probably all, they might say. This person literally hates humanity.
Oh dear, that sounds like a very unhappy way to live. Someone who sees the worst in everyone and everything. This is a very strong word, isn't it? A misanthrope?
Exactly, Rachel. A misanthrope. They are truly individuals who hate humanity. Think of those characters in literature who retreat from society, or perhaps some internet commenters who seem to find fault with everything and everyone. It's a deep-seated distrust and dislike of human nature itself.
It sounds like a lonely existence, and very different from just being a bit pessimistic.
It is. Now, for our eighth type, we narrow the scope of that hatred. Imagine someone who, sometime in their distant past, was deeply wronged, scorned, or profoundly wounded by a woman, perhaps a mother or a mother figure. As a result, they've built a carefully constructed defense against further hurt. They now hate all women. What is this person called?
That's very specific and quite sad. A deep-seated prejudice. Is this a misogynist?
Correct again, Rachel. A misogynist. This is someone who hates women. It's a powerful and unfortunately historically present term that describes a very specific form of animosity.
It's important to understand these terms, even when the concepts behind them are negative.
I agree. Understanding helps us recognize and address these issues. Now, for our ninth type, this person might famously declare, "Marriage is an institution, and who wants to live in an institution?" For them, making the ultimate legal commitment is out of the question. Members of the opposite sex are perfectly fine as lovers, roommates, or house sharers, but absolutely not as lawfully wedded spouses. The ties that bind are simply too binding for them. They might even believe, and for themselves, perhaps rightly so, that a commitment is deeper and more meaningful if freedom is available without judicial proceedings. This person hates marriage.
This sounds like someone who values personal freedom above all else, especially in relationships. Given the previous misogynist words, is this a misogynist?
Spot on, Rachel. A misogamist. They are someone who hates marriage. In a society like ours, where traditional marriage is still very much valued, this perspective might seem quite unconventional. However, it reflects a deep aversion to the formal, legal aspects of marriage, preferring a commitment that is not bound by institutional rules. It's a very modern perspective for some, while for others, it's a lifelong stance.
Yes, with rising divorce rates and changing social norms, more and more people are rethinking what commitment means to them.
Absolutely. And finally, for our 10th and last personality type, imagine someone who lives by a philosophy that champions self-denial, austerity, and lonely contemplation as the characteristics of a good life. They believe that the simplest food and the least amount of it that will merely keep body and soul together, combined with complete abstinence from fleshly, earthly pleasures, will eventually lead to spiritual perfection. This person leads a lonely, austere existence. What is this practice and the person who follows it called?
This brings to mind images of ancient monks or hermits living very strict, disciplined lives away from worldly desires. Is this an ascetic?
Precisely, an ascetic. They are individuals who lead a lonely, austere existence. Think of Buddhist monks or Taoist hermits who live in remote mountains dedicating themselves to spiritual practices, minimizing their material needs, and focusing solely on inner growth. It's a path chosen for spiritual development, often involving significant personal sacrifice.
Fascinating. So, we've covered 10 distinct personality types just by looking at their behaviors and core beliefs. It really puts a name to so many patterns we observe.
It does. And now that we have a good grasp of what these words mean, we're going to embark on an even deeper journey, exploring their origins and related words. This is where the true magic of etymology happens. Every word in the English language has a history, and these 10 are no exception. By understanding their roots, we'll unlock a treasure trove of other valuable English words.
Oh, this is my favorite part. It's like discovering the family tree of words.
Exactly. Let's start with the first two words we discussed, egoist and egotist. These two words are built on the same foundational Latin root, the pronoun ego, which means I.
I, the most important word for an egoist and egotist, it seems.
Indeed. For the egoist, I is the greatest concern in their mind. Their entire world revolves around I and what benefits I. For the egotist, I is the most overused word in their vocabulary. They can't stop talking about I.
That's a great way to differentiate them. So, an egoist thinks about I constantly, and an egotist talks about I constantly.
You got it. And here's a little trick from the sources to help you remember the difference. Think of the letter T in the word talk and the additional T in egotist. The egotist loves to talk about themselves.
That's super helpful. I'll remember that.
Now, the word ego itself has been adopted directly from Latin into English and is commonly used to refer to one's concept of oneself. For example, you might say, "What do you think your constant criticisms do to my ego?" It represents your sense of self-worth and identity. The sources also mention that ego has a special meaning in psychology, but we won't go into that today to keep things simple.
So, ego is like our inner self-image, our sense of who we are.
Precisely. But what happens if this focus on I becomes extreme? If you are an egocentric, egocentric, you literally consider yourself the center of the universe. You are an extreme form of the egoist. Imagine a child who believes everything revolves around them. Or in Chinese culture, we sometimes see this described as a Xiao Huang Di, or Xiao Gong Ju, a little emperor or little princess who expects everyone to cater to their needs.
Oh, I've definitely encountered egocentric people. They truly believe their problems are the most important, and their opinions are the only ones that matter.
Exactly. The word egocentric can be both a noun, as in, what an egocentric her new roommate is, and an adjective, like, he is the most egocentric person I've ever met. Now, let's take it one step further. If you are an egomaniac, egomaniac, you carry egoism to such an extreme that your needs, desires, and interests have become a morbid obsession, a mania. An egomaniac is not just annoying. They can be dangerous and are often described as slightly mad.
Wow, that's a big jump from just being self-centered. An obsession sounds serious.
It is. The sources help us differentiate the intensity. An egoist or egotist is obnoxious. An egocentric is intolerable. And an egomaniac is dangerous and slightly mad. So, the level of self-obsession escalates significantly. And to form the adjective from egomaniac, we simply add the common adjective suffix, al, giving us egomaniacal, egomaniacal.
So many words just from that single root, ego. It's like seeing a whole family branch out from one ancestor.
Exactly, and that's just one example. Now, let's move on to our second category of origins, words related to others. Remember our word altruist?
Yes, the one who dedicates their life to helping others.
Perfect. In Latin, the word for other is alter, and a significant number of valuable English words are built on this very root. The philosophy practiced by altruists is called altruism, altruism, which comes from a variant spelling of Latin alter, meaning other. And altruistic, altruistic actions are those that look toward the benefit of others.
That makes so much sense. Altruism is literally otherism, focusing on the well-being of others.
Absolutely. Now, let's look at some other words stemming from alter. If you alternate, A-W-L-T-I-R-N-A-T, what are you doing? Think about it in terms of other.
If I alternate, I do one thing, then the other thing. Like, I alternate between working on my computer and taking a break.
Exactly. You skip one and take the other, so to speak. For example, you might play golf on alternate Saturdays. Here, alternate is an adjective meaning every other.
Got it. So alternate can be a verb and an adjective.
Right. And it can also be a noun. An alternate, A-W-L-T-I-R-N-A-T, in a debate, a contest, or a convention, is the other person who will take over if the original choice is unable to attend. It's like a substitute or a backup plan.
So if the main speaker can't make it, the alternate steps in. Very clear.
And this also explains alternative, alternative. If you have no alternative, you simply have no other choice. The meaning becomes so clear when you realize the connection to other, doesn't it?
It really does. It's like seeing the hidden meaning in plain sight.
That's the power of etymology. Now, consider alteration, alteration. What do you think an alteration is?
An alteration is a change, right? Like altering a piece of clothing to fit better.
Perfect. An alteration is, of course, a change, a making into something other. When you alter, A-W-L-T-E-R, your plans, you make other plans. It's all about changing one thing into another.
This is so consistent. Once you grasp alter means other, all these words just click.
Exactly. And now for a more intense word, altercation, altercation. An altercation is a verbal dispute. When you have an altercation with someone, you have a violent disagreement, a fight with words. And why does it happen? Because you have other ideas, plans, or opinions than those of the person on the other side of the argument.
Fight with words sounds quite serious. So it's not just a small disagreement?
No. The sources say altercation is stronger than a simple quarrel or dispute. The sentiment is more heated. The disagreement is likely to be angry or even hot-tempered. It implies a significant difference in other views, leading to a strong verbal clash. Think of those intense debates you sometimes see online, where people are passionately arguing because they hold entirely other viewpoints.
Yes, I can definitely imagine that. It's when people are really dug into their other positions.
And finally, a beautiful term, alter ego, A-W-L-T-E-E-G-O. This combines alter, meaning other, with ego, meaning I or self. An alter ego generally refers to someone with whom you're so incredibly close that you both do the same things, think alike, react similarly, and are in temperament almost mirror images of each other. Any such friend is truly your other I, your other self, your alter ego.
Wow, that's a deep connection, like two halves of a whole, almost. In Chinese culture, we have Zhiji, Zhiji, a very close friend who understands you completely. This sounds very similar to that concept.
It's a perfect analogy, Rachel. A Zhiji is indeed a wonderful example of an alter ego, someone who truly sees and understands your other self. So, we've explored the ego family and the alter family. Now let's move on to our third big etymological journey, which relates to how you turn your personality.
Turn? Are we talking about our introverts and extroverts again?
Exactly. Remember introvert, extrovert, and ambivert? These words are all built on the Latin verb verto, which means to turn.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Intro means inward, extro means outward, and ambi means both. So an introvert turns inward, an extrovert turns outward, and an ambivert turns both ways.
You've got it perfectly, Rachel. The prefix intro means inward, extro means outward, and ambi means both. So, if your thoughts are constantly turned inward, you are an introvert. If they're turned outward, you're an extrovert. And if they turn in both directions, you're an ambivert.
The etymology really clarifies the core meaning there. It's so logical.
It is. Now, let's explore that prefix ambi a little more. We just said it means both. It's also found in the word ambidextrous, ambidextras. What does ambidextrous mean if ambi means both?
Both. And what's dextrous? I think it has something to do with skill. So someone who is ambidextrous can use both hands with equal skill.
You're absolutely right. An ambidextrous person is able to use both hands with equal skill. The noun form is ambidexterity. Ambidexterity.
That's a great skill to have. Like those amazing calligraphers who can write with either hand.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned dexterous means skillful. And you're correct. Dexterous, dex, trees, means skillful. And the noun dexterity, dex, ter, et, means skill. The sources tell us that dexter is actually the Latin word for the right hand. So, in an ambidextrous person, both hands are right hand, so to speak, meaning both are equally skillful.
So the right hand is associated with skill. That's interesting.
It is. Traditionally, the right hand was considered the more skillful one. In many cultures, the right hand is associated with good fortune and ability. It's only in recent decades that we've really started to accept that lefties or southpaws, as they're sometimes called in English, are just as normal as anyone else. Yet, even today, the term left-handed is still sometimes used as a synonym for awkward.
That's a fascinating cultural insight. In China, while we don't have such strong negative connotations, traditionally, there was often an emphasis on using the right hand for writing and eating. So this idea of right being associated with skill resonates somewhat.
Yes, it shows how language can reflect historical biases. And this becomes even clearer when we look at the Latin word for the left hand, which is sinister.
Sinister? As in evil or threatening?
Precisely. This same word, sinister, in English, means threatening, evil, or dangerous. This is a further commentary on the early suspiciousness of left-handed people. It's quite striking how a simple physical trait could lead to such negative associations in language. The sources even mention that some parents used to force left-handed children to switch hands, which could unfortunately lead to problems like stuttering or difficulty reading.
That's really sad. To think a natural difference was seen as something sinister, it highlights how important it is to be aware of the origins of our words.
It really does. Now let's look at the French connection. The French word for the left hand is gauche. And as you might suspect, when we adopted this word into English, we also gave it an uncomplimentary meaning.
So if I call someone gauche, gosh, it's not a compliment.
Definitely not. If you call someone gauche, you're implying clumsiness, generally social rather than physical. It's like being socially awkward or tactless. For example, a gauche remark is tactless, something inappropriate to say in a situation. A gauche offer of sympathy might be so bumbling that it's actually embarrassing. And the noun gaucherie, gaucherie, describes an awkward, clumsy, tactless, or embarrassing way of saying things or handling situations. The gauche person is totally without finesse.
So someone who commits a social faux pas or says the wrong thing at the wrong time would be gauche. Like if someone makes a joke at a funeral, that would be a very gauche thing to do.
A perfect example, Rachel. It's all about lacking social grace or tact. But thankfully, there's an opposite to gauche. The French word for the right hand is droit. And we've used this word to build our English word adroit, adroit.
So if droit is right hand, and the right hand is associated with skill, then adroit must mean skillful.
Exactly. Needless to say, adroit, like dexterous, means skillful. But it especially refers to skill in the exercise of mental faculties. Like gauche, adroit, or its noun form adroitness, is usually used figuratively. The adroit person is quick-witted, can cleverly get out of difficult spots, and can handle situations ingeniously. Adroitness is, then, quite the opposite of gaucherie.
So an adroit person is someone who is clever, skillful in thinking, and quick to respond, like a brilliant debater or a skilled diplomat who can navigate tricky conversations with ease.
That's a fantastic description. It shows how the same root, draw, gives us a word that signifies mental agility and cleverness, a stark contrast to the social clumsiness of gauche. This whole hand etymology is just fascinating, isn't it?
It really is. It shows how deeply ingrained cultural perceptions can be, even in our language.
Absolutely. Now, let's move on to our final and perhaps most intriguing category of origins, focusing on our words related to love, hate, and marriage.
Oh, this sounds juicy.
It does. Remember our three words that expressed hatred: misanthrope, misogynist, and misogamist? These three words are all built on the Greek root misein, which means to hate.
Misein, to hate. That's a powerful root.
Indeed. So, the misanthrope hates mankind, and this comes from misein, to hate, and the Greek word anthropos, which means mankind.
And the misogynist hates women?
Correct. This is misein, to hate, combined with the Greek word gyn, meaning woman.
So I guess the misogamist hates marriage then?
You've got the pattern now. That's misein, to hate, plus the Greek word gamos, meaning marriage.
It's incredible how knowing that one Greek root, misein, unlocks the meaning of all three.
It's the beauty of etymology. But now, let's look at the other words that come from these Greek roots, not just the hate words. Let's start with anthropos, meaning mankind.
Okay. What else comes from anthropos?
Well, it's found in anthropology, anthropol-a-g. What do you think anthropology is?
If anthropos is mankind, then anthropology must be the study of mankind, or the study of the development of the human race.
Exactly. The study of human beings and their cultures, societies, and development. And here's a contrasting word to misanthrope: a philanthropist, philanthropist.
Philan? Does that mean love?
You're close. The root philo often means love. So, a philanthropist is literally one who loves mankind. They show this love by making substantial financial contributions to charitable organizations or by donating their time and energy to helping those in need.
Ah, so the complete opposite of a misanthrope. A philanthropist is like those generous individuals or foundations that donate huge sums to build schools or hospitals, or volunteer their time for social welfare programs like the Hope Project in China. That's a beautiful word.
It is indeed. It shows the spectrum of human feeling towards mankind. Now, let's look at gyn, meaning woman. Can you think of any English words built on this root?
Well, a specialist who treats women's health issues, a gynecologist.
Perfect, Rachel. A gynecologist, gynecologist, or gynecologist, is the medical specialist who treats female disorders. So, you see how knowing gyn helps you understand that medical term?
That's super practical. It gives meaning to a word I already knew, but didn't quite understand the origin of.
And finally, let's explore the Greek root gamos, meaning marriage. This root occurs in several important words. Can you name any types of marriage?
Of course. There's monogamy, bigamy, and polygamy.
Excellent. And you might already know what these prefixes mean. Monos means one, bi means two, and polys means many.
So, monogamy, me, is the custom of only one marriage at a time. That's the most common form of marriage in many parts of the world, including China.
Exactly. And bigamy, bijami, if bi means two, what is it?
By etymology, it's two marriages. But I know legally it means something more specific, like being married to two people at once, which is illegal.
You're absolutely right. While etymologically it means two marriages, in actuality, bigamy is the unlawful act of contracting another marriage without divorcing one's current legal spouse. It's a serious legal offense.
So it's not just two marriages, but two concurrent and illegal marriages.
Precisely. Now, what about polygamy? Polygamy. If polys means many, what does that signify?
Many marriages. That sounds quite complicated.
It can be. By derivation, polygamy means many marriages, and etymologically, it could refer to plural marriage for either males or females. However, in current usage, it generally refers to the custom practiced in earlier times by groups like the Mormons, and even before them by historical figures like King Solomon, where the man has as many wives as he can financially and emotionally afford.
Ah, so a man with multiple wives. Is there a more precise term for that specific type of polygamy?
There is. The correct, though rarely used term for this custom is polygyny, P-L-I-J-A-C-E. This combines polys, many, with gyn, woman. So, literally, many women or many wives.
That makes sense. It's good to have the specific term. But what about the other way around? What if a woman has two or more husbands? I've heard that practice exists in some parts of the world.
That's an excellent question, Rachel. And yes, that custom is indeed practiced in certain regions. For example, in the Himalaya Mountains of Tibet. That specific form of marriage is called polyandry. Polyandry.
Polyandry. How is that formed?
It combines polys, many, with the Greek word andros, which means male. So, literally, many males or many husbands. It's fascinating how language provides such specific terms for different social structures.
This whole discussion on marriage types, from monogamy to polyandry, really opens up a world of cultural diversity, all through the lens of word origins. It's so much more than just memorizing definitions. It's understanding concepts and histories.
And that, Rachel, is exactly the goal of Word Wonders. We started our journey by understanding individual personalities, from the self-absorbed egoist to the selfless altruist, from the inward-looking introvert to the outward-facing extrovert, and all the shades in between, including the hateful misanthrope, misogynist, and misogamist, and the austere ascetic.
And then we peeled back the layers to see how these words are built. We explored the ego family with its roots in I, leading to words like egocentric and egomaniac.
We journeyed into the alter family, discovering how the Latin word for other gives us altruism, alternate, alteration, altercation, and the beautiful concept of an alter ego.
And we learned how our personalities turn with the Latin root verto, giving us introvert, extrovert, and ambivert, and how the right and left hands, dexter and sinister, and droit and gauche, shaped words for skill and clumsiness, even reflecting old cultural biases.
Finally, we uncovered the Greek roots for hate, misein, mankind, anthropos, woman, gyn, and marriage. Gamos. This helped us understand misanthropy, misogyny, misogamy, and even the nuances of monogamy, bigamy, polygyny, and polyandry.
It's amazing how much information and understanding is packed into these word origins. It's like each word is a tiny history lesson in itself.
It truly is, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed this deep dive into personality types and their etymological roots as much as we have. Understanding these origins not only expands your vocabulary, but also gives you a deeper insight into the concepts themselves and the fascinating history behind the English language.
It definitely makes English feel more alive and connected to a much bigger story. Thank you, Chris, for guiding us through this wonderful journey.
My pleasure, Rachel. And thank you to all our listeners for joining us on Word Wonders. We encourage you to observe the personalities around you and see if you can spot these types. And especially to think about the origins of the words you use every day. You'll be surprised at what you discover.
Don't forget to practice those tricky pronunciations, especially for our longer words.
Absolutely. And join us next time as we unravel even more linguistic mysteries. Until then, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep wondering about words. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.